Enemy of the State, now on A View from the Bunker. There's an ancient proverb that says, those whom the gods wish to destroy, they first make mad. If there is a modern update to that proverb, it would probably be something like this. Those whom the government wishes to destroy, they first declare mentally incompetent to stand trial. Our guest tonight in the bunker is a woman who is, one of the only American citizens ever arrested under the USA Patriot Act, declared mentally incompetent to stand trial, and we'll get into that ordeal in her own words in just a moment. She is a journalist, and she's been a speechwriter and congressional staffer for Peter DeFazio, representative from Oregon, Representative Ron Wyden from Oregon, Senator Carol Mosley Braun of Illinois. But the story gets much deeper than that. We'll get into that right now with our guest, Susan Lindauer. Susan, welcome to the bunker.
Thank you so much for having me on tonight.
We had the wonderful opportunity to talk with Jay Fields back in 2006, April of 2006, an interview we presented in three parts about your situation, which has obviously changed since then. Thankfully, you're no longer incarcerated, which is a important thing. But take us through what happened, what led up to your arrest. And this was in 2004, was it not? Your arrest in March of 2004?
And yes. My story is an American nightmare. I was arrested on the Patriot Act and accused of acting as an unregistered agent of Iraq. In fact, I had been, in addition to being a congressional staffer and working for Senator Carol Mosley Braun and Ron Wyden and Peter DeFazio, I had also been a U.S. asset involved with anti-terrorism work at the Iraqi embassy in New York. And I was one of the only American citizens allowed to have contact in a back channel with the Iraqi government. And every single thing that I was doing was supervised by the CIA and the Defense Intelligence Agency.
So you were an asset? Were you an agent of the CIA or just an asset reporting to the CIA?
I was an asset reporting to the CIA.
Okay.
But I was able, it's actually very an important distinction. I'm glad you raised that because assets are not paid employees of the CIA, but we are private citizens who have some kind of specialty which gives us access to a special target group. For example, I was actually an anti-sanctions activist. And I was an anti-war activist, and so the United States government came to me and asked if I would be willing to use my anti-sanctions work to establish contact with Iraq and Libya, of all places, and if I would make, because I could get into those people and I could talk to them at a time when they were pariahs, and nobody was able to get in there into their embassies. I mean, the Libyans wouldn't talk to anybody at the time that I was doing this. And I ended up having about 150 meetings with both embassies.
Now, who was it within the government?
Several years.
Who was it within the government that approached you with this project?
I was approached first by the Defense Intelligence Agency, and then my contact at the Defense Intelligence Agency introduced me to somebody at the CIA. And both of these gentlemen, Paul Hoven and Richard Fuse, debriefed me constantly, supervised me heavily. I was never out there alone. It would be totally wrong for anybody to think that the United States government would just allow an American citizen to establish these contacts and kind of go off and do something without heavily trying to control what they're doing. That
sure.
would be like, I had like weekly meetings with my American contacts. And I was meeting with the Arabs about once every 3 to 4 weeks, and I was meeting with Paul and Richard at least once a week, each of them. So it was heavily controlled.
Now, I can understand.
What happened is after the war, I knew things that they didn't want anybody else to know.
Now, which war are you talking about? The 1991 Gulf War or
no,
the
2003? The 2003.
Okay.
After the invasion of Iraq, the United States government had a problem. They wanted to tell American citizens certain facts about pre-war intelligence, which were not entirely true. And they were kind of inventing. They were playing very, very loose with the facts. And when I say very loose, I'm being a little bit sarcastic, because in fact they pretty much made the whole thing up. There was very little truth in anything that the United States government was telling people. And that's when I got to be a real problem, because I was an anti-war activist on top of being an asset. And I had come out very strongly against the war. And so they weren't going to be able to lie if they had the assets out there ready to tell what had really happened. And so they arrested me on the Patriot Act. My cousin was the chief of staff to George Bush.
Andrew Card.
Andy Card. Mm-hmm. Andrew Card. My second cousin. People always get upset and they say, well, he's your second cousin. Yes. But they also wrongly presume that I didn't know him. And that is absolutely false. Andy Card and I had known each other back 20 years. When I was in college at Smith College, his younger brother, Brad Card, used to come visit me at college, and I used to spend all of my holidays in Holbrook, Massachusetts, where Andy Card lived, with my cousin, with my Aunt Mimi. And so, in fact, we had a very, you know, I would see him on the holidays every time I went home. And so, you know, we did have, you know, he was much older than I was, yes, and I was actually friendly with his brother. However, it's not that we didn't know each other. Mm-hmm. That's just ridiculous. I mean, there's been several presumptions about my case that are just wrong.
So this letter that you presented to Andy Card said what?
The letter to Andy Card warned him that war in Iraq would be disastrous. And it said that there would be a rise of Al-Qaeda. It said their democracy would throw power to the fundamentalists, and that the Iraqi people had been so badly damaged by sanctions that they would never support the United States for very long. It was a very simple, it was actually a very short letter. I ended by saying that I would pray for Andy. There was nothing hostile in the letter. It was not an angry letter or a threatening letter. If it had been, that would have been a totally different situation. Mm-hmm. But I never threatened him. I said, I will pray for you. I hope you will support peace. You know, try to keep God in your life right now. I mean, it was actually kind of, you know.
And when we interviewed Jay Fields back in 2006, he had posted a scanned copy of the letter to his website. And I believe that letter is still available online. This letter now was presented prior to the invasion of Iraq.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. 3 months prior to the invasion of Iraq. And because I had been an asset, and I had been a back channel on anti-terrorism, I told Andy in the letter that if there was something that the White House wanted to get from Iraq, that I would do everything in my power to try to help them get it. And I would be willing to use my contacts at the Iraqi embassy to try to help the United States get whatever it wanted. Because, you know, this war would be such... I wanted to help Andy do everything in his power to make the war avoidable and unnecessary. Mm-hmm. So that doesn't mean that I would have succeeded, but it certainly meant that I was willing to try. And in fact, Iraq had made a substantial peace offering through our back channel, which had been developed over the previous 2 years. Iraq had, when people don't realize that when Iraq first agreed to resume the weapons inspections, was actually right before, it would be November 2000. It was when they were still counting the votes in Florida. They didn't mm-hmm. know yet whether it was going to be George Bush or Al Gore who had won the election. And at that point, even then, Iraq was willing, it was coming forward to say that they wanted to resume the weapons inspections, and it would be a very short conversation. Colin Powell later picked up the language out of one of my Andy Card letters and told Congress that it would be a very short conversation about whether they resume the weapons inspections. That's actually what the Iraqis had communicated to the White House. So it was actually, he was actually repeating what they said to us.
So Now, looking at your history then as a sort of an unofficial back channel of the United States government, reporting to an officer within the CIA, Dr. Richard Fuse, and being the second cousin of Andy Card, and having delivered this letter to him prior to the invasion of Iraq in January of 2003, and of course we went in March of 2003. Your contacts with Iraq go back to what, 1995? Is that right? Or 99?
My contacts with Libya go back to May of 1995. My contacts with Iraq go back to August of 96.
Okay.
And again, I must emphasize, and just I've got to underscore this point. The CIA came to me and asked me to establish this. I was already working with the CIA on this project for about a year.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, about 9 months before I actually made the contact. So I was debriefed heavily, educated as much as possible before I was ever turned loose on them. And then everything that I did was heavily controlled on the other end. So they didn't just say, hey, why don't you just go do mm-hmm. this and let us know how it goes.
Well,
that's not what was happening.
My point in bringing back the length of the context you had with Libya and Iraq prior to your arrest in March of 2004 is to establish for listeners that the government knew for a good 7 or 8 years before you were arrested on March 11th of 2004 that you had had regular and ongoing contact with Iraqi intelligence services. So
yes, indeed, that is absolutely true. And when they arrested me, I had said that I had been working in anti-terrorism, and in fact that was the whole focus of my work was anti-terrorism from the very beginning, because that was what we wanted most from Libya. So I had been engaged in this back-channel anti-terrorism work for years. And it really makes a lie out of when Congress says that they give outstanding leadership support for counterterrorism work when you have your assets in prison without a trial, without a guilty plea, arrested on the Patriot Act.
Mm-hmm.
So that they can make up stories about their anti-terrorism work. It turns out that what they've been telling people is just not true.
Now, what happened after you were arrested in March of 2004?
Well, what was interesting was I immediately said, okay, I want a trial. I am not interested in a plea bargain. I want to defend my reputation. I understand that if I am convicted, then I'm going to have to do some prison time. But before you get your conviction, you're going to have to go into court and you're going to have to explain this to a jury. And I'm going to explain my stuff to a jury as well. And I think that I'm innocent, and I think a jury's going to agree with me. Because when they, you know, I was accused of acting as an Iraqi agent, and I was like, well, actually, I can prove I was a U.S. asset, and I can prove that you came to me and you asked me to do this, and I was reporting back to you, and I was acting in good faith. And as far as I'm concerned, you have no business calling me foreign agent. If you're coming and doing this with me, and if I'm acting in good faith with you, then you shouldn't be accusing me later on. The other thing that they had done was they had accused me of very small, stupid little things, like to try to justify the charges. They said that I had been in New York. Now this is actually true. This is not a joke.
Mm-hmm.
They accused me of eating a cheeseburger. I'm not making this up. They accused me of having three lunches totaling $92.92. Which, if you break it down, each lunch was like my half of those three lunches was $46, and then if you have three lunches for $46, it's $15 a lunch.
Well, that's a pretty nice cheeseburger. That's a pretty nice cheeseburger, though, Susan. I mean,
yeah, $15 in New York City.
Okay.
And that's with tax and tip. Okay. Now, I'm going to tell you something. You want to send me to prison for eating a cheeseburger? No. And then it turns out that I was not in New York on those days. The visa receipts, thankfully, were date and time stamped. So, that, for example, we knew we could look at it and say, okay, this lunch was at 1 o'clock in the afternoon on this date, and it was paid for with this Visa card. Okay, great.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it turns out that the diplomat in question had a girlfriend named Susan.
Huh, okay.
And I could prove that I was in Maryland on those days, and that the charges were ridiculous. Okay? The charges were very silly. To accuse somebody of eating a cheeseburger is not a... I just refuse to believe that that's a criminal offense. And especially if I can prove that I was not in New York City on that day at that time, and that there's a reasonable explanation for it because the diplomat had a girlfriend with my name. Okay, it's just a stupid charge. So what happened was, but it becomes very important, because what happened was, when I said, well, I'm not going to plead guilty to this, and if you're not going to drop these charges, then I want a trial.
Mm-hmm.
So what they said was, okay, you are so convinced of your innocence that you do not appreciate the gravity of the charges against you. Therefore, you are not capable of assisting in preparing your defense.
Really?
That makes you incompetent to stand trial. And I'm like, but it's a damn cheeseburger. You're eating a cheeseburger. How ridiculous can this be? And they're like, oh, no, no. You believe in your innocence so strongly. And I'm like, but I can prove that I wasn't in New York on that day, because we have, like, computer records. We had hard evidence proving, you know, we had bank records, and we had things that we could, telephone records. We could prove that I was in Maryland. It would be impossible for anybody to say that I was not in Maryland. And we're talking about a darn cheeseburger here.
And this was the compensation you were supposed to have received as this unregistered agent of the government of Iraq.
There you go.
Okay.
Yes.
And so because you weren't willing to deal with the government, they declared that you weren't mentally capable of assisting in your defense, which thus made you incompetent to stand trial altogether.
Yes,
why would they do that? Why would the government do that? This is a question that, and when we talked about your story 3 years ago, and we discussed this a bit on the forum that accompanied our podcast, some of the questions that came from intelligent, well-meaning people were simply this: why would the government go to all of this trouble and go to this effort to declare this woman mentally incompetent if she were not, in fact, mentally incompetent to stand trial?
Because it's a very, very good, very simple answer. They declared me mentally incompetent because they did not want to acknowledge what I knew as an asset. They were able to pull that argument for people who did not understand what I really had been doing, and they did not want anybody to understand what I'd really been doing. Because we had, from the start of the Bush administration, the Iraqis had been trying to negotiate a peace option with the United States. And the peace option was quite extraordinary. It included the weapons inspections. Iraq was always willing to have the weapons inspectors come back in, which people didn't know. People thought that Iraq was trying to keep them out. Actually, the United States was refusing to go back in because they were afraid that they weren't going to find anything. It's one thing to attack somebody and say, oh, you've got this hidden away. And it's another thing when they actually open the doors and say, come on in and check us out, and you can't find anything. The United States pretty much knew that was going to happen. But the other thing is that the Iraqis were offering a whole bunch of stuff on terrorism and a whole bunch of stuff on financial contracts for American corporations. For example, on terrorism, which was my specialty, okay, they were offering us, one, financial records on key al-Qaeda figures.
Hmm.
We would have been able to identify bank accounts that were being used by al-Qaeda, and then working forwards and back, we could trace where the money was coming from, where it was going. Some of that would be legitimate. I mean, some bank accounts would not know, some investment corporations would not know where their money was, that it was illegal money. and others would be corrupt.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were going to be able to identify financial transactions and banking records. We were also going to be able to get the FBI into Baghdad with a task force authorized to conduct investigations, interview witnesses, and most crucially, to make arrests.
Hmm.
There were some people that Iraq wanted to give to the United States, like a young man named Zarqawi.
Really?
Now, some people, yes, they tried to give us Zarqawi. They wanted to give us Zarqawi. We wouldn't take him.
Hmm.
Yeah. And
now, there are people who are listening to this, I'm sure, and thinking this can't possibly be true. And I would direct you to the research done by former federal prosecutor John Loftus, who wrote what I think was just a blockbuster article about the imprisonment of Jonathan Pollard, who was imprisoned for spying for Israel, but in which he discloses that what Pollard's real crime was not turning over sensitive information to the Israelis, but was turning over information to the Israelis that shows that the United States knew prior to 9/11 that some of these people who were later involved in the attacks on the World Trade Center, that the Saudis knew who they were and that we weren't prosecuting them or chasing them down. So this is another tentacle of the octopus, if you want to think about it that way. And I will put links to all of these things in the show notes at PIDradio.com.
Excellent.
So that, because as we say many times, don't take our word as gospel. I mean, go dig into the information for yourself and make your own conclusions. So the government then...
But there's a lot of stuff that they really... The United States government, it's really hard for people to understand even now that the United States government would deliberately lie.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to think like that. We don't want to think that we live in a country where the government is less than honest and accountable.
Right.
But they're not accountable. They're not fully honest with us. They do play games with us. And unfortunately, they've been playing a lot of games with Iraq. And I'm actually finishing a book right now.
Really?
That will be called Extreme Prejudice.
Extreme Prejudice.
Which goes into the whole, which documents Iraqi pre-war intelligence. And it's not even just taking my word for it. I mean, I've got documentation for everything. So,
and
the cover-up and all the abuse that I suffered as they tried to restrict access to this information.
Now, I definitely want to cover that because that, I think, is at the heart of this whole story, and it's chilling when you think about what the government can do when they really want to keep somebody quiet. But just as a question, most Americans, all we knew about what Saddam Hussein was like, what his policies were through the major media, the information we received from the 24-hour cable channels or ABC,
uh-huh.
CBS, NBC. And everything that we saw indicated that Saddam Hussein was a belligerent, that he was opposed to American interference in his nation right up to the very end until we pulled him out of that spider hole. What information did you receive through your contacts that led you to believe that Saddam was just putting on a show, or was Saddam merely putting on a front? I mean, why was he so opposed to the United States and the Western world, just documenting that he had given up his weapons of mass destruction?
Well, it's very interesting because that's really a story that was made up by the corporate media. In fact, for 2 years prior to the weapons inspections, Saddam and the Iraqi government repeatedly promised to let the weapons inspectors in and to allow them unfettered access to all weapons sites. There was another side to it, however, that was important, and that was Iran. Saddam was not the kind of person to be terrified. of anything, which was part of the problem. But he had a natural fear of Iran's power, and he thought that if the Iranians believed that they had that Iraq had absolutely no protection, then Iran's belligerence would grow. And he saw the Shiite in his own country as, you know, a contained threat. And if Iran started poking too much, then it would let loose this torrent that was being contained. And I think that's a fair assessment of what would have happened. I think he was right about that.
Well, his
opinion of the United States, however, was very different. Saddam hated Islamic fundamentalists, but he was very Western oriented, and he was very open to the United States. And the Iraqi government was very perplexed that we presented them as being hostile to the United States, because they would always say, you know, we want to be your friends. We have a natural, Saddam always had his eye on Iran, and he always said that Iraq should be a buffer to Iranian ambitions.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've talked many times about Shia, and especially the Twelver strain inside Shia Islam, and why anyone thought that removing Saddam, who, you know, okay, he's a bad guy, I get that, but why removing?
There are a lot of bad dictators in the world.
There are, and we can't fix them all. But why taking him out of the way and allowing then the Shia majority in Iraq to write a constitution, which of course is based on Sharia law, would result in anything but Iran's new best friend, seeing as how Iran is the only other Shia majority nation in the world, would happen? I mean, it was either a colossal miscalculation on the part of the Bush administration, or it was intended this way all along for some other reason. I can't figure that out.
I will tell you, I'm one of the few people, for the fact that I was called incompetent, part of the thing in my book is that I was one of the few people who was actually saying that that if they went to war, Iran would emerge as a regional power,
mm-hmm.
That would dominate the Middle East, and that if they did this, they were setting up Iran to be in a superior position, and we were going to be playing the back door to a very weak Iraqi government that was would ultimately end in confrontation between those two powers.
Well,
I think that's what's going to happen.
And that may well have been the end game all along. If you read the letter from the Project for a New American Century, Iran was always been in the sights of the neocons. So this may have been part of the grand scheme. But we'll set that aside for another program, because I really want to get to what can happen to an American citizen under this new world, this post 9/11 world in which we live. So you were declared incompetent to stand trial. What happened to you left? Were you released on bail
recognizance? Let me start by saying, first of all, I was arrested on the Patriot Act.
Right.
And the Patriot Act being the worst provisions of the Patriot Act, I, an American asset who had worked in anti-terrorism for 9 years, I was subject to secret charges that I was never allowed to know what they were, secret evidence that I was never allowed to see. I was held under indictment for 5 years. My charges were dismissed 5 days before the Obama inauguration. In those 5 years, I was never allowed to see one grand jury statement, never allowed to see one FBI interview.
Now, as a defendant, aren't you supposed to be able to see the charges and the evidence that's been presented against you?
In the United States Constitution, you better believe it.
Yeah.
But under the Patriot Act, no. Under the Patriot Act, they can withhold all evidence from you and just say, you are charged, kid. You don't have any right to know what those charges are. We don't even have to tell you what you're accused of doing. We don't have to provide any evidence. And if we went to trial, if we had gone to trial, the prosecutor would have the right to stand up before the jury and say, hello, we have not shown you what activity she participated in, but just take my word for it, she did it. And you have to convict her because we tell you to. There would be no evidence. I mean, try to comprehend this where you could ask somebody to be convicted without evidence and without even identifying what the activity was.
On what grounds can they justify doing that? Is that in the Patriot Act?
It's in the Patriot Act.
I mean, is this justified on the basis of national security? I mean, if we present the evidence in an open court, we would be compromising national security.
Well, that's what they try to say. But the facts are that if you're accusing somebody of something, then you have the right to answer the evidence, and you have the right to know what you're charged with. And the other side of it is that the grand jury statements, I'm certain, and the FBI interviews, I'm certain, were not all negative towards me. Even evidence that would exonerate me of the charges, we were not allowed to know about. So if somebody said, well, you know, actually, you know, she is telling the truth. She is an asset. She really did this. Oh, yes, she did all of that. They wouldn't be allowed to tell us what that was. I mean, think about that. You could spend years in prison without ever seeing the grand jury statement and without ever reading the FBI interviews, and those interviews may have cleared you of all the charges. And you wouldn't even be allowed to know about it or use it or present it to a jury.
And when you say you, you also mean your attorney.
Yeah, exactly. And in addition, yeah, it would be the defendant, and then it would be the attorney as well. Now, here's something else that's kind of really frightening, is that an attorney could file for a security clearance. And depending on their security clearance, they could receive a portion of access to information. But any information that they received, they would be prohibited from sharing with the defendant. And therefore, you see, so even if your attorney knew what it was, he wouldn't be allowed to tell you what it was. And in my case, there was we have the documentation, we can prove it. There was a classified debriefing in my case. And right before this, we were moving towards what's called a government defense. And I was going to go into trial and say, okay, I was a U.S. asset, I was supervised by the CIA, I'm not guilty. And then it's up to the jury. You know, if a jury didn't believe me, okay, you'd convict me. Mm-hmm. But I would have the right to present that to the jury. Mm-hmm. And that's the key. The whole thing is due process. Do you have the right to go into a trial? Do you have a right to make a defense? Do you, you know, and what they did was they, after the secret debriefing, all of a sudden, without telling me, nobody even told me, my attorney was not allowed to inform me. They were not going to use a government defense anymore. They decided they would declare me incompetent. And that instead of, you know, they didn't have any grounds for saying I was insane. Mm-hmm. It was not an insanity defense. This was a defense that said you are not competent to assist in the preparation of your legal defense.
So what? They're saying you were just an idiot? Or delusional
pretty
or
much.
What?
Yes, yeah. They tried to say several things. They tried to, and every time they said it, I would attack them, and then one story would fall away. So then they would try to find another one, and I realized that you have a faith in God, and I realized some of your listeners have a faith in God, and I want to say that I have a faith in God. However, I also understand that some of your listeners do not believe in God, and I'm okay with whatever people's values are. I'm very libertarian. I have a very strong personal belief. But I'm confident enough in what I believe that I don't worry about what other people believe. As long as we're all happy living our lives and not hurting anybody and not, you know, not breaking down our society, then I'm okay with that. Do you see where I'm going with this?
Sure, sure.
But in psychiatry hates religious faith. I was astonished. I'm not even a radical Christian.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not even like, you know, like some, like Sarah Palin or some people like that are very, 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 very rigid, very, very, very conservative in specific values and beliefs. And I'm much less than that. And but I believe in God.
Mm-hmm.
And so the fact that I just believed in God and that I love God, these could sound funny on the radio, but I'm happy believing in God, you mm-hmm. know? I mean, if people are unhappy, then that's too, then I don't want them to, you know, I mean, I hope loving God, believing in God doesn't make you unhappy.
No.
You know, I sure hope it doesn't make you unhappy, but it sure makes me happy. So if I'm happy living my life the way that I choose to live, and if I'm spiritual or try to be spiritual, and if I try to appreciate things that are given to me, and if I try to be mindful of blessings, well, you know, I can use some language that religion uses
mm-hmm.
that really describes those things very well. But in psychology, they hate that. They hate it.
So
they attack it.
They basically said, because you believe in this invisible, imaginary being that you call God, you must be mentally incompetent to stand trial?
They did, yes. That was a big part of the argument. And they attacked me for believing in angels. They ridiculed some of the things that they believed, that they tried to make it sound like were kind of, you know, yeah, I do believe in angels, mm-hmm. yes. I do.
Oh, we're told that they exist. I mean, you know, we're told that they exist between the covers of the Bible. So,
yeah.
All right, I'll accept
you know,
that.
I do believe in angels. I do believe in God. I do believe that, you know, I mean, but where psychiatry gets really freaked out, which I think is none of their business,
mm-hmm.
is they think that, you know, like, I believe that I have a personal relationship with God.
Mm-hmm. You know what's really interesting?
Just, I believe it.
What's really interesting? I did an interview last week with Dr. Michael Bennett, who gave a presentation last summer to the International Institute of Integral Human Sciences, which is an NGO registered with the United Nations, founded by an Anglican priest. They are very much into finding alternate ways to communicate with other entities. In other words, opening portals to talk with, other entities.
Okay.
And he said the thing that really struck him, because, you know, like me, he's a conservative Bible-believing Christian. He gave his presentation mm-hmm. saying, look, we believe that these portals can be open and that you can communicate with other entities. But as a Christian, I have a different take on what this is about than you do. And so he gave his presentation and discovered through talking with people at this conference afterwards that a great many of them are involved in the mental health profession, psychologists, psychiatrists, and yet...
Really?
Yes. So while you may have... So it's interesting that your experience with this used your faith in God against
you. But you know what I found? Like, one of the guys who attacked me was involved. You know, he said that he wrote two books about the Kabbalah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay, now I'm not, you know, the Kabbalah. And I'm like thinking, oh, well, that's cool. Then you understand how people have spiritual lives. And he was like, well, I am never going to let those people take credit for what they think they do. So what these people do is they go to these conferences, mm-hmm. not all of you, not like your friend, not like the man you interviewed,
right.
but some of these psychology people go to these conferences, and they're really two-faced. I've decided, so I really hate psychology. I have to tell you, I really hate these people. And I find that you think that you're having a very reasonable conversation with them. You know, like I'm saying, yes, I believe in God. Yes, I have a personal relationship with God. It makes me happy. It makes me feel like I'm, you know, it gives me a good sense of values and a good, you know, mm-hmm. Morality is for when you're in a dark room, as far as I'm concerned. It's like when all things are black and you need to, you turn to the core of your being to figure out what to do, that's when you need morality the most.
Right.
And if God is like, if I was like going out and killing people in the name of God, then you could say, okay, something's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm just, you know, mindful of the beauty of this great earth and this magnificent creation, then mm-hmm. I mean, how can you be angry at me for that? But I'm thinking that I'm having a really reasonable conversation with some of these people, and then it turns out that they're out there saying, ew, she is so delusional that she thinks God cares about her. She thinks that God would have time for little old Susie Lindauer.
Mm-hmm.
you know?
Well, now to the point, while all this was going on and these deals were taking place behind the scenes to formulate the government plan to declare you incompetent rather than letting you stand trial and prove your and make your defense in open court. Yes. Where were you? I mean, were you traveling back and forth to these meetings from your home, or were you behind bars?
Good question. For the first 18 months, I was free. And then I was under orders. They had made a false claim that I was suicidal right before my arrest, which was a lie. Because of my religious values, I would never be suicidal at all. Mm-hmm. That is not possible. I don't believe in that. But they said it anyway, and once they made the accusation, they were allowed to order me to go through court-ordered counseling. So for the first 18 months, I was home on bail, $500,000 bail, and the only stipulation was that I had to go to a weekly psychology meeting. And really, they were very boring. I had nothing to say to these people. I thought they were very dumb meetings, but it was a court order. Okay. But the good thing about that was that it documented for a year. I actually only did it for a year, and then I said I wouldn't do it anymore. But for a year's worth of observation, they documented that they saw no evidence of depression, no mood instability, no psychosis, no schizophrenia, no hallucinations, no reason for any further or additional psychiatric intervention. Okay, so I come away with a clear bill of mental health, no problems. After this, I am then declared incompetent, and I am ordered. It's actually the scariest thing that had ever happened to me in my life. My attorney told me that the judge wanted to see me in New York City. That's where my charges were. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, why does the judge want me to come to New York? Of course I will, because if the judge orders me to do it, I'm going to do it. But why are we being ordered to go to court? We had not had a court date in 18 months. And my attorney says to me, gosh, Susan, I have no idea. I don't know why the judge wants to see you in New York on next Thursday, but you've got to be there.
Uh-huh.
So I called up my uncle, who is an attorney, and I said, something's odd. Something's going on right now, and I don't know what it is, but I would like you to come with me. And my uncle came out from California, and we both went to New York together, and we walk into the courtroom, and they said, surprise, we have decided that you are incompetent to stand trial. You are not going to be allowed to have a hearing on this competency question. We are deciding that we're going to send you to prison on a Texas military base for a period of 120 days. Mm-hmm. That's 4 months. And in 120 days, they're going to decide whether you could become competent to stand trial or whether it's just a hopeless cause and you're just permanently incompetent. And my attorney turns to me and says, well, if you're permanently incompetent, then they're going to have to drop the charges because they can't go forward. Oops, good for you. So here they have conned me without my knowledge or consent. They have arranged with each other, the prosecutor and my public defender attorney, mm-hmm. not a private attorney. It's got to be understood. This was a public defender. And I didn't have any money to hire an attorney, and my case was very complicated, and it would have taken a lot of money.
And a public defender going up against the United States government is understandably perhaps a little intimidated?
Yes, yes. And it's a lot of – this is an easy defense to get out of the Patriot Act. And I'm sure that he looked at it and said, look, she's going to be declared incompetent, and yes, it's insulting, but she'll be free in 4 months. And then I don't have to deal with this case anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Well, okay. So what I said, well, I got furious, and I said, I want a hearing. You're not going to send me to prison on a Texas military base without a hearing. And they said, and my uncle was like, Susan, my uncle was smart. My uncle said, Susan, if they send you in, you have no guarantee you're going to get out. Mm-hmm. So you better fire this attorney right this minute. Don't play any games. You need to tell the courts you don't want this attorney, you're against it, and you're demanding your rights to a hearing. So my the attorney disappears to go in to talk to the judge, and within about 2 minutes, the judge's clerk comes back to us and says, we understand that you're thinking of firing Mr. Tolkien as your attorney. We want you to know that if you ask for a hearing, which is guaranteed by the statute,
mm-hmm.
the statute says you are absolutely entitled to a hearing with witnesses and evidence to prove that the findings of competence are wrong if you don't like them. Every defendant is entitled to that.
Mm-hmm.
If you exercise your rights to that hearing, we will seize you immediately and take you to prison, and you will forfeit your bail until the end of the trial. Or, if you agree to surrender voluntarily, you will have 10 days to get your affairs in order, and I have a mortgage. I had to pay my utility bills. I had to mm-hmm. find a way to take care of my animals and, you know, take care of my home and everything. And I would be given 10 days before I had to surrender to prison. And then at the end of the 4 months, I could come back and tell the court that I still wanted to have a hearing.
Mm-hmm.
So after I served the prison sentence, then I would be allowed to have the hearing at the end of it.
Okay.
Do you see?
So now, so you surrendered.
It's like, let's have the trial after we convict you and after we sentence you.
So now you surrendered and were sent to Carswell, Texas. Is that correct?
Carswell, yes. Carswell Air Force Base in Texas. It's right outside of Fort Worth.
So why did they send you to Carswell, Texas? I mean, didn't they have some place closer to Maryland that they could lock you up?
Yeah, well, you know, that's very interesting. We even asked about a place called St. Elizabeth's, which is the hospital right down here in Washington, D.C., where John Hinckley is located.
Okay.
And that would have meant that I could have been here in D.C.
Mm-hmm.
But Texas is the only women's hospital healthcare in the federal prison system. And it's very important to know I was not held in a mental institution.
Okay.
This was a prison. This was a full-scale prison that included a hospital for, you know, everything from AIDS, HIV, cancer, heart conditions, diabetes, blood pressure, you know, any kind of medical problem that you had would be treated at this place. And there were about 1,400 prisoners, and about 900 of them had some kind of physical illness. But it's a very dirty, as in corrupt, dirty place. I've been writing about this in my book, and how women who had finished their sentences were not being released after they completed sentences.
Really?
They completed their sentences entirely, and Carswell would not release them. I knew somebody who had received, the United States Supreme Court had issued a decision striking down her conviction and issuing a writ of habeas corpus.
Right, uh-huh.
Whereby she would be released immediately. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
The Supreme Court didn't send her back for new sentencing. They said get her out of the prison. She should be home. Carswell held her for another 5 months and refused to do the paperwork for her release, even though she had a Supreme Court order for her release.
How could they get away with that?
Corruption. but what they did to me was they were supposed to hold me for 120 days, and at the end of that they said, well, we don't want to let you go. And they began, they knew that I had a very weak public defender who didn't really care what happened to me at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so they said, well, we're just going to hold you, and we're going to see if we can forcibly drug you. And I refused. I was like, oh, no, you're not. Oh, no, you're not going to do that. I'm not going to put poison in my body.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I began to fight back. But the kinds of things that they tried to attack me with, every time they'd come at me with one thing, I would shoot it down, and then they'd move to another thing, and then they'd attack me on that, and I'd shoot that down. Like, for example, the fact that I believe in God was part of the original decision that I was incompetent.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? I was found incompetent on two bases. One, that I believed in God, and including the fact that I believe in angels,
mm-hmm.
and I believe in prophecy, and I believe that God has a personal relationship with me.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And the second thing was that I believed so strongly, and this was really the first thing, the reason number one, was that I was believed so strongly in my innocence that I did not believe that I would be convicted at trial. And therefore, because I did not believe that I could be convicted at trial, I should not even have a trial, and I should be sent straight to prison. When I got to prison, seriously, can you believe that? And then when I got to prison, they floated the idea that maybe I wasn't an asset. Maybe I was delusional for thinking that I was an asset.
Uh-huh.
And I said, oh, no, 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 no. And I had witnesses in France and Canada who pounded them with phone calls until they finally forced their way to let these interviews happen. And then they verified that it was all true,
mm-hmm.
because I'd done Lockerbie. So we were able to verify some witnesses tied to the Lockerbie case. The Scottish solicitor who was involved in the Lockerbie case was going to be one of my witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
And a big investigative journalist who'd written a book on Lockerbie and had done a lot of research on Richard Fuse, he was going to be another witness. A couple of other attorneys associated with Lockerbie were going to testify for me. So, I was going to have like three or four attorneys testify on my behalf.
And testifying to your connections with members of the intelligence community?
Yes.
Okay.
And testifying about Richard Fuse's identity in the CIA and the fact that he'd done, they had done extensive research on his background and his credentials in terrorism,
mm-hmm.
and that I was known to have a long-term relationship with them and that they had confirmed this with Arab sources.
Mm-hmm.
So, I was covered on all different ways. But what happened was that Carswell initially falsified testimony about me and falsified testimony in the case. And if any of us did this, we would be arrested for perjury.
Right.
But when psychiatry does it, it's somehow tolerated in the courts. And I think that that needs to change.
Well, yeah. and these charges that were brought against you, these analyses, evaluations done by the court appointed, and I presume the psychologists who interviewed you were appointed by the court?
They worked for the Bureau of Prisons.
Okay.
And they were all associated with the Texas military base. So you have to realize, I'm an accused Iraqi agent.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, try to get your arms around this. This is huge. I am accused of acting as an Iraqi agent. I am not accused of espionage. But for most people who hear this charge,
mm-hmm.
they would presume that I was accused of espionage.
Well, and most of the major media accounts that were coming from the likes of the New York Times actually called you an accused spy.
Yes.
Even the last report that I was able to find by a major news source about your case, which was from September of 2008, the New York Post, in reporting that a psychiatrist that you had hired to evaluate your mental condition, in that story, the New York Post called you an accused spy. So it's the story that was put out about the major media, the mainstream media, Byron York writing for, I forget what publication he writes for, National Review, I guess, in writing about you, had made at least the implication, by guilt by association, I suppose, that what you were doing was spying and passing information on to the Iraqi government.
Exactly.
So, but anyway,
on a Texas military base,
right.
That is going to go over really badly.
Well, sure.
When you looked at the charges, there were three major charges against me. One, that I was acting as an Iraqi agent,
mm-hmm.
which implies that I'm spying, which is false. Secondly, it said that I was in conspiracy with Iraqi intelligence, which Lord only knows what that means. And the third thing was that I was, quote, organizing resistance to the United States, which implies that I'm supporting some kind of military action or subversive insurgency.
Treason.
To harm American soldiers, which is ridiculous. I was, in fact, supporting democracy, free elections, free political parties in Iraq. And it's just like when you look at my actions and you look at the charges, there's no relationship between them at all.
Well, you know, and by writing that letter to your cousin, who was the president's chief of staff, and by doing it for what amounted to three cheeseburgers, Susan, you're just not a very good secret agent for a foreign power. I guess that's the power, the problem there.
Yes.
Now,
that's right.
Now,
that's right.
Now, you're down in Carswell, Texas, and they're wanting to drug you. What was the purpose of the drugs that they proposed to inject into you?
I will read you a statement because I won't, you know, when I tell you this, you can't really believe your ears. But if I read it to you, you will, you'll cry. And it's very short. They wanted to give me. The drugs they wanted to give me are, and I have this, this is a paper, this is a document from the U.S. Department of Justice Federal Bureau of Prisons, Carswell. This is an actual document from the government. Okay. It says proposed treatment, antipsychotics, benzodiazepines, antidepressants, mood stabilizers. Now, I looked at this, and I about... I can't even tell you how frightened I was. The summary of evidence against me. Ms. Lindauer reported she was against medication of any kind, including psychotropic medication. She denied the possibility of mental illness, once again reporting in detail her belief that the government is having her detained because she represents a threat to the administration due to her differing beliefs about their policies on Iraq. She states she has been a government agent for 9 years working in, quote, anti-terrorism. Lindauer denied any wish to hurt herself or others and denied any history of aggressive behavior. That is the basis of evidence for why I should be drugged. There is no evidence that I was hallucinating, or, which I don't, or suffering any kind of auditory or visual hallucinations, no accusations of schizophrenia, no accusations of depression. In prison, I walked 4 to 6 miles every day on the outdoor track. That is approximately 120 laps a day. On the track, because I had nothing else to do.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I was a motivated prisoner. I was very the reports say that I was very functional. I had zero behavioral problems. I was very compliant. When the guards asked me to do something, I went along with them and just did it because it was, you know, you're in prison, you're going to do what you're told to do.
Right.
There's some prisoners who are disruptive and abusive.
Mm-hmm.
I am not one of those people. I'm just going to go along and just, you know, do my time as quietly as I can. I don't need to harm anybody or harm myself. But the reason for the drugs was to cure me of believing that I had worked as an asset and to cure me of believing that I had been involved in Iraqi pre-war intelligence.
Oh,
but
boy.
The facts are that I was an asset and they knew it. I had had two of my witnesses contact the prison and they had very carefully gone through all these relationships and all of our history and we weren't taking any chances. You know, so I was like, okay, you know, if I'm being attacked like this, we need to get somebody to talk to these people. And they did. My witnesses were quite cooperative. Moreover, my uncle, who was an attorney, he had done – now, here's the key. My uncle had been – my public defender had done a very lousy job and really was overwhelmed. So when he was overwhelmed – we got ready to replace him. Before Carswell ever happened, we were moving to replace him.
Mm-hmm.
So my uncle done some of the interviews with these most important witnesses just so that he could verify that we really did have a defense. Okay? And my uncle had 40 years in the law. He was 69 or 70 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew what qualifies as real testimony and what's hearsay and what's admissible and all this stuff that I don't even know. You know, I wouldn't know that. I wouldn't, you know, be able to distinguish what's hearsay and not hearsay. But the facts are my uncle was satisfied that we had top-level witnesses who were going to be capable of proving my story was true. And so my uncle told Carswell that he had verified it, and then my witnesses called and told Carswell that it was all true. So they knew it was true, and they lied about it in federal court.
Hmm.
And under psychiatry rules, there is nothing to stop them from doing that. People don't understand. People think that if you're going to testify in court, you have to be honest. But the facts are that you don't have to be honest, and no one's going to do anything if you're not.
Were they successful in administering these antipsychotics?
No way.
No.
No. They suggested it to me, and what I just read you just now was mm-hmm. actually from an internal hearing at Carswell. And I rebutted each charge. For example, I said, you want me to take antidepressants? Well, and they wanted me to take Haldol, Prozac, and Ativan.
Hmm.
And I said, well, wait a minute. Let's start with the Prozac here. I don't suffer from any depression. I'm a highly motivated, active individual. I'm not going to take antidepressants for you. No.
Mm-hmm.
And this Ativan mood stabilizer, I'm very mellow and low key. I'm not going to take drugs for non-existent conditions. And as for the delusions, you've already interviewed these witnesses and you know it's true. And if you falsify a report to a federal judge, you would be guilty of perjury in this case. And that's where so I said, I will not do it. And at no time ever did I. But then they went into court and they went back to Judge Mukasey.
Mm-hmm.
Judge Mukasey, who later became the United States Attorney General.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Later became United States Attorney General. This was his last decision on the bench. And they actually falsified testimony to him and tried to pretend that I was delusional. And I kept saying, you know, here's a list of witnesses. I rebutted it aggressively.
Mm-hmm.
I came and I said, you know, here's a list of my witnesses. I challenge this court to obey the law and hold a competency hearing, which is required by the statute, and have a competency hearing, and you can call these witnesses. They will come into court, and you can ask them directly. Here's their names, addresses, phone numbers, email addresses. I mean, I had everything. I wasn't taking any chances. And I said, here's all the ways that you can contact these people, and you call them into court, and you can ask them as many questions as you want, and the law says that I'm entitled to a competency hearing, and wouldn't you know, nobody wanted that to happen.
Hmm.
They didn't want me to have a trial. They didn't even want me to have a competency hearing.
So what did Judge Mukasey rule?
He ruled on his last day at the bench. He was about to retire, and he ended up holding me for about 4 more months after the hearing.
Hmm.
And then on his last day in office, he issued a decision in my favor saying that defendants who are not violent do not have to be drugged. And it's actually a very good decision for everybody. And it has now been used, I'm glad to say, in other cases. Where they're saying that if you're not the question is, are you violent or not violent?
Mm-hmm.
If you're violent, then there are other rules that would apply. But if you're not a violent person, then they can't just forcibly drug you for no reason. But even Judge Mukasey cited my belief in God. And he said, you know, she believes in angels. Well, that's kooky. You know, and I'm like, you know, gosh, I like angels. I'm sorry. But, I just think that's just bizarre.
So you spent about
attack somebody for believing in God. I just don't know what's happening in this country if we're going to go to this level now.
Well, unusual, especially for those conservative Christians who like to think that the George W. Bush administration was friendly to them. I think that this is another example. Of course, the work that David Kuo produced, his book, following his decision to talk about what he saw inside the Office of Faith-Based Initiatives and the way the White House very cynically cultivated relationships with evangelical leaders, is, I think, just more proof that there is no political party that actually represents mainstream, well, I shouldn't say mainstream, that represents true Christians. And I think we ought to get to the point where we understand that we can't vote Jesus into the White House, and we should quit trying. But you know, that's a topic for another day.
Let me tell you something though before you get off this subject. The prosecutor in my defense against me, the prosecutor who was attacking me, who sent me to Carswell, who declared that my belief in God was, he ridiculed me in court. I went back. I had a 4-hour hearing on forcible drugging, which is the most terrifying thing that I've ever heard, because I don't put drugs in my body at all. I am totally opposed to drugs. I'm very libertarian. If there are other people out there who do, you know, you do what's right for you. I am not going to do it. I don't do that at all, ever. I abhor drugs.
Well,
you know, I take aspirin. I do. But I realize that I'm too extreme for some people, but these are my beliefs. But I'll tell you, the man who did this to me went on to work for Sarah Palin in Alaska. And he worked on her campaign staff, Edward O'Callaghan. Look up his name. It's true. Edward O'Callaghan, O-C-A-L-L-A-G-H-A-N. And he went to work for John McCain and Sarah Palin. And he was advising them on anti-terrorism policy. And this is a guy who's a crook, who attacked assets who worked in anti-terrorism, and then and attacked religious faith, and then immediately after, and this is like within a few weeks of this hearing, where I get a little bit. You may want to cut this part back a little bit, because I get really upset. Where I start to get really, really upset. So
that's all right. So again, 8 months in Carswell, and then finally Judge Mukasey rules that you don't need to be drugged. What happened then? I mean, were you then finally released?
I was released.
But the charges were still hanging over your head.
Yes. I was held in prison a total of 11 months. I was held in Carswell for 7 months and then 4 months in New York City.
Okay, so Judge Mukasey had you there in New York City instead of down in Carswell.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, and I was terrified of Carswell by that point. I was like writing him letters pleading with him not to send me ever back to Carswell, because I thought that what they did to the women in Carswell was so frightening. And I was just like, I beg you, don't do this. Please, please, please. You know, I was like, Your Honor, I'm happy. You know, I don't take my word for anything. Call my witnesses. Here's a witness list. I beg you. I beg you to call these witnesses into court and ask them yourself. Ask them anything you want. But give me the chance to show you that it's true.
So, but while Judge Mukasey ruled that you did not have to undergo the forced druggings, he did not overturn the ruling that you were incompetent to stand trial. Is that correct?
Exactly.
Okay. So basically, it's like, look, we'll let you out, but we're still not going to give you a chance to bring your evidence to court.
That's right.
And then finally...
And so I was held under indictment for 5 years without a trial. I was released from prison I was arrested March 11th, 2004. I was sent to prison on October 3rd, 2005, 18 months later. I was held in prison for 11 months until September 8th, 2006. And then from September 8th, 2006, my charges were held and active until January 15th, 2009.
Just before the inauguration.
just before the inauguration.
Was it just a coincidence that your arrest took place just as the presidential campaign of 2004 was ramping up?
Oh, coincidence, yes.
Yeah, I'm a prominent...
Even those things.
Yeah, I'm a pretty serious coincidence theorist.
Seriously. I had gone to, about 30 days before my arrest, I had gone to the offices of Senator Trent Lott and Senator John McCain.
Ah.
And I had asked to testify before the brand new blue ribbon presidential campaign, Commission on Iraqi Pre-War Intelligence.
Ah, okay. So it wasn't...
I asked to testify. I told them what I called John McCain's staff, and I got out my address book, and I have family in Arizona, and I went through every zip code of, you know, Tempe, Chandler, Phoenix, Scottsdale, Tucson, Mesa, Payson, Pine Top, all the different places in Arizona where I have family who live there right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I want my family to know the truth about Iraqi pre-war intelligence. They're your constituents, and my family has they're red-blooded Americans, and they have a right to know what I was doing for real. And then I called Senator Trent Lott's office, and that is actually recorded by the FBI because the FBI had wiretaps on my phone.
Mm.
And so we have all the records of that, of my asking to testify to Trent Lott's office. And within 30 days of that, I was arrested.
Well, I think...
And they did not want this stuff coming up in the presidential campaign.
That would be
Well,
that would be my guess. I doubt anyone will ever admit that. But the timing of this, you know, 6 months before the hotly contested election between President Bush and John Kerry, could have been a game changer.
Yes.
One of the reasons that you came back to mind and that I got in contact with you, Susan, was a few weeks ago, as Sharon and I were recording PID Radio, we talked, of course, about the deal between Prime Minister Gordon Brown of the UK and Muammar Gaddafi, concessions given to British Petroleum in exchange for the release of Abdelbaset al-Megrahi, who is the man convicted of the Pan Am Flight 103 bombing over Lockerbie. Your handler or contact in the CIA, Dr. Richard Fuse, had some information about that. And so that is why your name came up during that program. And when I thought, well, maybe we can get in touch with Susan and find out what's going on with her now. But I'd like you to share what you know about the Pan Am Flight 103 case as it relates to the guilt or innocence of Abdelbaset al-Megrahi.
Yeah, let me tell you, let me just give your listeners a little bit, a short snapshot. Pan Am 103 was bombed on December 21st, 1988.
Mm-hmm.
And immediately after that attack, it was quickly discovered that Syria and Iran had been conspiring to blow up an airliner as a punishment for the U.S. attack on from the Vincennes, which had been in the Persian Gulf. The Vincennes had shot, it was a U.S. aircraft carrier or something, that shot down an Iranian jet.
Oh, right, okay.
It was carrying Hajis back from Mecca.
Okay, right.
Okay, and so it shot down an airplane that was carrying pilgrims from Mecca by mistake, they say. But,
mm-hmm.
of course, whenever you're involved in Iran and the United States, it's never a mistake. It's like nobody's gonna ever accept an apology.
Mm-hmm.
So the Iranians said that they would punish the United States for shooting down their airplane, that they were going to bomb or attack an American airplane at one of our holidays, at our Christmas holiday, like an eye for an eye kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So we all knew that this was coming. The United States knew that something was going to be done. And in fact, intelligence reports show that you know, we do have it. I have seen first personally observed and witnessed and read over documents showing the planning of this attack. Okay. And it shows that Syria and Iran did it together. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, immediately after the bombing of Pan Am 103, which crashed on the roof of Lockerbie, Scotland, it was an airplane that had come out of Frankfurt, Germany, and it was as it was flying over Scotland, the bomb went off and it crashed down on Lockerbie. Okay, at that time, everybody jumped on Syria and they said, "We know who did this. It's Ahmed Jibril, Abu Talib, and Abu Nidal."
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And everybody knows this. When George Bush Sr. wanted to bring Syria and into the war with Iraq in 1990,
mm-hmm.
the first Gulf War, and he wanted their cooperation, he agreed that he would take off the burden of Lockerbie and pass it on to somebody else. So George Bush the First agreed that he would stop prosecuting Syria and stop publicly blaming Syria for that attack. It was a very cynical thing to do, and they shifted that burden then on to Libya. Well, Libya in the 1980s was involved in certain terrorist attacks,
mm-hmm.
but it was not involved in this one. And unfortunately, it's really a terrible thing because the men who did the attack are famous terrorists who had bombed other airlines, including Northwest Airlines, Israeli Airlines.
Mm-hmm.
They did the Achille Lauro cruise ship attack.
Right,
they bombed the Israeli embassy in Buenos Aires. They were involved in several assassinations of Jewish scholars and pro-Israeli politicians in Sweden and Norway, and they bombed some synagogues. Abu Nidal was involved in 200 attacks, most of it tied to anti-Israeli sentiments.
Mm-hmm.
And Ahmed Jibril was the founder of kind of a branch of militant Hezbollah called the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine General Command.
Mm-hmm.
And so we know who did these things.
What evidence do we have that they were responsible for Flight 103?
Well, we watched them planning the attack, and what happened was, this is something that we observed as they were doing it. Okay, so first of all, we had sources inside Iran,
mm-hmm.
who were reporting on the meetings between the mullahs of Iran and these individual terrorists, and so we have that kind of specific evidence. We can watch the, we can monitor the planning from A to Z.
Mm-hmm.
A, B, C, D, right down the alphabet. You just go straight through, and it's always to every part of it is tied to these men. And it's really unfair that I believe that somebody would be attacked for this just because they had a Libyan nationality. And yet that's pretty much what we did.
So why did Gaddafi...
Megrahi was chosen because he worked at He was a small little baggage handler, airline check-in person at the Libyan Airlines in Malta.
Okay.
And so he was just some little guy, he wasn't a sophisticated terrorist who would be able to, find a timer and figure out how to put it on an airplane and how to, he would have all the millions of dollars necessary to finance this kind of stuff. I mean, it's just like picking somebody. He's a patsy.
Mm-hmm.
And the men who did this are skilled professional terrorists. That's the only thing they ever do is bomb things. And they're very well connected. So the reason that we were so angry about that was, we're letting the big guys off the hook.
Mm-hmm.
Why are we doing that? Why would you want to protect Ahmed Jibril and Abu Nidal and Abu Talib? We agree that terrorism is a terrible thing and an awful thing, and we should prosecute it. But you only go after people if they're really doing it. You don't waste your time, on plumbers and c- construction workers and little guys who are just kind of like, you know, taxi drivers.
Well,
you spend your time on, no, you only if they're doing something.
No,
we never tried to entrap anybody.
No,
No,
and I understand that. And I the point is that there are somebody back behind the scenes pulling strings who understand that you got to throw somebody to the wolves, and the person who gets thrown to the wolves generally are not the ones who are connected to, not the ones who are well connected. So,
that's,
you know,
right.
As much as I hate
that's
to
right.
add another conspiracy to the research pile here, it is at least plausible to consider that there are powerful forces and men who want Abu Nidal and his colleagues to remain free, or at the very least would find it more embarrassing to throw those guys into the hopper and let them take the fall for what they did rather than Abdel Basset al-Megrahi. I mean, the official story is one that's put out there for the benefit of those who have a lot to lose if the true story were to come out. And that, again, Susan, is why we're talking with you.
Let me add two or three little things about that. Abu Nidal Abu Nidal confessed to Lockerbie. He confessed to his family and friends that he did it. After his death in Baghdad, when he was killed in a shootout with Iraqi intelligence,
right.
His family and friends spoke up aggressively, frequently claiming his involvement in Lockerbie and saying, for God's sakes, free this man. We know that my father did this, or my brother did this, my husband did this. Everybody was saying that he did it. And he said, we're ashamed that you've got this innocent man in prison for this. Okay, so even Abu Nidal knew it was wrong. But Abu Nidal was involved with the BCCI scandal. BCCI. Look that up, guys. I won't go into all the details
well,
of that.
Well, that's a
Abu
tangled
Nidal
web.
Was a, yeah. Yeah, it is. And you know, and then the other thing is that some of the men involved with Kassar was another terrorist involved with Pan Am 103, and he was involved in the heroin traffic coming out of the Baca Valley.
That's a very interesting point, because there's a book, and I hate to interject here and stop you, but there's a book that was written by Carol Marshall under the pen name Sherry Seymour, or vice versa. I think Sherry Seymour is her name actually now. Carol Marshall, the pen name, called The Last Circle, in which she claims to have talked with people who claim to know that the actual reason that the plane was bombed was that DEA agents returning from Crete or Malta, one or the other, had evidence that American intelligence assets were involved in this drug trade.
Yes, indeed.
Okay.
Yes, indeed. Would you like me to explain how that worked?
Please.
Now, I had a very interesting conversation with somebody who, when I was actually at Senator Carol Moseley Braun's office in 1996, when I had first started contact with the Libyans, somebody showed up. I was walking down the street, standing in front of the United States Supreme Court, of all places, and somebody turned up and said, "Hi, Susan. I want to take you," and I'm just like, "Who are you?" And he's like, he never identified himself. He said, "I want to take you to lunch, and I want to tell you some stuff about Lockerbie." Okay, so he does. And he told me that the, and Richard has confirmed this.
Richard Fuse, okay.
Richard Fuse has confirmed this, that, let's see, let me pull my thoughts together for a second. You may have to cut this out a little bit so I can, like, say, I'm kind of like, okay. Okay, that the Defense Intelligence Agency, let me back up here.
Fine.
The CIA The CIA was tracking the hostages that had been kidnapped in Lebanon, okay? Mm-hmm. And the CIA, one of the hostages was the CIA station chief, William Buckley, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And he had been viciously tortured before he was killed. Brutally, brutally tortured. As badly as you could ever be tortured by anybody. Broken bones, eyeballs hanging out, ripped to pieces. Okay, and then his body had been dumped in front of this so-called secret offices of the CIA in Lebanon. Okay, so the CIA knew that they had other prisoners who were being held hostage, and they were afraid that those people were being tortured as well. They realized these were bad men who had these guys.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so allegedly, they tolerated getting involved in heroin trafficking and tolerated knowing about the heroin trafficking so that they could establish contacts within this crazy circle of jihadis who were so vicious. And believe me, these were really horribly vicious people.
Mm-hmm.
These were as crooked and dangerous and malevolent as you ever get. Their game was to synchronize bombing attacks. And there were people who who thought that it was really cool to have like 11 or 12 bombs go off simultaneously throughout the city at exactly the stroke of midnight or 3 o'clock in the morning. I mean, this is how they function. This is the craziness of this world. And so you do realize that if somebody's being held hostages by these people, they're in terrible danger.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were taught, they say, their side of it, according to this man who came to me representing their side of it, was maybe you shouldn't judge us too harshly. Because if we were tolerating heroin trafficking coming into the United States, which is what they were doing, then we were actually doing it for a very good cause. Now, the problem with that is that they weren't just they weren't just tolerating heroin to come into the United States. They were actually profiting from it. They were taking a cut of the pay.
Now, you say they. Who is they?
The CIA.
CIA, okay.
The group of the CIA that was doing this was actually getting some money from it.
Mm-hmm.
And they were then saying, well, okay, but we're getting the money, but then we're using the money for our operations in the Middle East. So the defense intelligence people complained about how the CIA was doing this, and the defense intelligence people were coming back to Washington on Pan Am 103 so that they could have a meeting in Washington, D.C., with the CIA and the Defense Intelligence Agency to sit everybody down in a room and say, stop trading heroin out of the Bekaa Valley and stop taking these profits, and we don't want you to be using profits from heroin trafficking to finance CIA activities.
Mm-hmm.
Because what you're doing is you're keeping alive the terrorist activities. Heroin has always been a currency in terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're supporting the heroin trafficking, then you're supporting the terrorism. And we don't want you to do that. So they were coming back to complain about it, which is when the bomb just so happened to go off on that airplane.
Yep, yep. That's exactly what Carol Marshall wrote. And I'll put a link to that book in the show notes because it's available to read online for free at a couple of different sites. And I'll put a link to that in the notes so that you can, again, read through it and see this chain of events.
Yeah,
and again, for listeners, it's huge, huge thing to try to get your mind around. But remember, we're talking about a government that, over the course of the last 50 or 60 years, and has been documented through testimony in front of Congress, that this is a government that dosed unwitting subjects with things like mescaline and LSD and plutonium in the interest of national security. This is a government that actually speculated during the Eisenhower and Kennedy administration, actually proposed shooting down an American passenger jet with an American fighter jet painted to look like a plane from the Cuban Air Force in order to justify going to war with Castro. So it's not to say that the government of the United States is inherently evil, but there are certainly forces within it that are. And that is who must be opposed and who we must stand against. It does not matter what political party you're with, because this is an evil that crosses political party lines. The Vietnam War, the National Security Agency, about a year and a half ago, had to come out and admit that, actually longer than that now because we were still in Missouri, almost 2 years ago, admitted that it knowingly falsified intelligence about the Gulf of Tonkin so that President Johnson would fully commit to the Vietnam War. So these are things that have happened. There are forces operating within the government that are doing these things, and this stuff needs to be exposed to the light of day.
That's right. It sure does. And part of a good thing to remember is that there are always factions in intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
So there are different groups that are all working against either. It's the dynamic of democracy. Everybody's wrangling and fighting and squabbling over their different political agendas. And it's not a unified thing. Most people think intelligence is all in unity. And everybody's marching together. They're not marching together, believe me. And it's more creative and dynamic. And the guy who came to see me in front of the Supreme Court was absolutely convinced, I'm sure, that he denied taking any money himself from the heroin trafficking coming out of the Baca, but he defended the policy to me that they needed to establish contacts with those groups that were holding the hostages. And he rationalized that it was necessary to save those men's lives because these were such brutal, vicious, cruel people that they would be horribly abused and that after you rescued hostages, then you could go in and you'd have all the intelligence you needed to stop the heroin trafficking. But in the meantime, he was willing to tolerate the heroin trafficking.
Mm-hmm.
But there were others within that were factions related to him that were actually taking profits from it. So, you know, again, even if you're on the same side, there could be subgroups.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
Well, this
and
is
I'm against it, so I'm against heroin trafficking, so that's not even a question for me.
This is a fallen world, and certainly the powers of this world are subject to the entity that Jesus called the prince of this world or the god of this world. So we shouldn't be too surprised or shocked when we see things like this going on. Susan, I know we've covered a lot of ground this afternoon and still have only barely scratched the surface. But in the interest of keeping this a manageable file size for people who want to download the show, what are you working on now?
I enjoyed it. This was wonderful. Thank you for having me on, Derek.
Well, I look forward to talking with you again when your book is ready, if not sooner. The book you're working on is tentatively called Extreme Prejudice?
Yes.
When do you hope to have that in the publisher's hands?
By the middle of October. I'm almost finished with it.
Wow.
I've been working on it for 6 months. I kind of went to ground for a while so I could focus exclusively on my book.
And who is the publisher? Do you have a publisher?
I have an agent, and part of the problem we have is that publishers like the corporate media are afraid of taking on these issues.
Mm.
But my agent has several publishers who I'm going to protect their anonymity for the moment.
Okay.
He's got two or three who are very interested in it, and as I've been able to present a more complete manuscript, I've been able to reassure them that I can document everything. You know, you got to realize part of the problem was if you're accused of incompetence, you have a higher burden of proof.
Yeah. That's how they, that's how they destroy you. They declare you mentally unstable or incompetent, and then your credibility is called into question. Well, why would they do that if she wasn't really crazy?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, we'll look forward to seeing that when it comes out, so do stay in touch. Susan Lindauer, one of the only Americans arrested under the USA Patriot Act, incarcerated for many months, but yet never brought to trial. And Susan, it has been an honor and an education to talk with you.
Thank you very much, Derek.
We'll keep you posted on publication information for Susan Lindauer's book. And once it's out, it should make for some very interesting reading indeed. Now, it's a pretty safe bet that Susan's politics, based on her history as a staff person for the likes of Senator Carol Moseley Braun, are probably on the far end of the spectrum from Sharon's and mine. But that's okay. That's not the point. The point is that the United States government believes that it can take someone like Susan Lindauer, who has information that it finds embarrassing or potentially dangerous, and essentially lock that person up and then prevent that person from presenting a case in open court by declaring that person mentally incompetent to stand trial. That should send a chill down your spine, regardless of your politics and the politics of the person in question. Because while you may agree with the politics of the administration today, as we saw in the last election, that can change very radically in a very short period of time. The bottom line is, we live in a country where this shouldn't happen. I mean, it shouldn't happen in any country, but the Constitution of the United States allegedly protects us against such things. And the case of Susan Lindauer shows that, sadly, we are not as protected by the Constitution, and maybe never were, as much as we would like to believe. If you have comments, questions, or criticisms for us, you can address those to us a couple of different ways. First, by email. You can send that to radio@peeringintodarkness.com. That's radio@peeringintodarkness.com. Or you can address it to us by voicemail. We've got a 24/7 phone line open for your calls. It is country code 1, followed by 317-489-9350. Again, that goes to a Skype voicemail system, so don't worry about waking us up, regardless of where you are in the world. That's 1-317-489-9350. We apologize for not getting a PID radio podcast put together this weekend, but the process of taking up the carpeting on the stairs leading up here to the second floor bunker annex, and then sanding, filling nail holes, staining, and then waiting for the stain to dry left us a little more physically fatigued than we expected. So, God willing, we will have a PID radio next week. Next week on View from the Bunker, Constance Cumby talks about the convergence of the New Age movement with evangelical Christianity. You don't want to miss that. Until then, I'm Derek Gilbert. Thanks for listening. This is A View from the Bunker.